As you just observed, we prefer to hear what we expect to hear. Harmless, perhaps, when looping the sound of horses, but it's a principle often applied by those who would exploit the weaknesses in our information ecosystem. That's according to Ryan Holiday, author of Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator. He confesses on page one to lying, conniving, and bribing the media on behalf of best-selling authors and billion-dollar brands. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, you're repentant.
In a way, yeah.
And yet, you confessed to planting false stories in a number of news outlets just prior to publishing the book. So, is this yet another manipulation for the benefit of Ryan Holiday?
The shorter answer is, if I wanted to manipulate people, I probably wouldn't write a book saying what a manipulator I am and giving away all my easy manipulation secrets.
Unless you're sick of doing it.
Right. And I am. And that's part of why I'm writing the book, to sort of end this party with a bang.
Briefly describe the business model of the internet that makes it so particularly easy to manipulate. Because let's stipulate, there was plenty of media manipulation before there was an internet.
Of course. But I think it's far more prevalent, far less noticed than it ever has been before. Blogs are paid by the page view. A blog has an infinite amount of content that it could produce, and every piece of content is more money in its pocket. So the equation is traffic times CPM, the amount they're paid per page view, equals their revenue. So it's this race to the bottom to get as many page views as humanly possible, and that pressure makes blogs do really bad, lazy things.
Okay, so let's get to the cheating, lying, and bribing that you describe in the book. Begin with trading up the chain.
Where do reporters find their stories? What people like me do is, knowing where the radar of the influencers is, we can register on that radar artificially and create sort of buzz and momentum that gets picked up and then reified through the rest of the media.
So give me an example of how you used it.
I opened the book with the story of the movie campaign that I did for the author Tucker Max. And what we did was we placed billboards strategically around the city of Los Angeles, which then I vandalized and took cell phone photos of and leaked to two local blogs in Los Angeles, Curbed LA and Fishbowl LA, knowing that they would bite on that story because it was someone they'd written about and someone they were interested in. They, of course, did. And then I took links to that story and I anonymously sent them to a bunch of bigger blogs, including blogs like The Village Voice and Gawker, who then picked it up. And then the next thing you know, we're being denounced in the editorial page of the Chicago Tribune and the Washington Post because these reporters read those sites and then they see their role as sort of a popularizer of the online buzz.
And these denunciations in the big national papers were a triumph.
Yeah, they were exactly what we wanted. It was one of those movies where the boycott is what makes everyone go to see it. And that's what we wanted to create.
And the movie was called?
I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell.
Not a huge amount of harm done in that case.
No.
But there are cases in which great harm is done. You use the example of Pastor Terry Jones, who threatened and then carried out the burning of the Quran, which resulted in riots in which 27 Afghan citizens were killed.
I think he started as a local sideshow. He would sort of do offensive things that pertain only to his church, to his local community, and he got the occasional story written about him by the local paper. That happens enough times, and now the Miami Herald takes notice. And now he's getting blog posts from all over the world. And when someone like Terry Jones sees suddenly that he has a national platform, he steps up his game. He gets crazier and crazier, and now he says, I'm going to burn a Quran. The media system can't police itself, and it can't say, no, we're clearly being manipulated here, let's not cover it, because the traffic is there, and traffic matters more than anything else.
And you quote a Wharton School research project, which looked at 7,000 articles on the New York Times most emailed list.
Yeah, and the number one predictor they found was anger. Anger is the number one predictor of an article making that most popular list. And it's not just anger, it's any high valence emotion. So humor is one, awe is another. But let's look at the emotions that aren't viral. Those are emotions like sadness or contentment or satisfaction. they're not in the interests of the media creators to propagate.
Now right. Let's talk about bribing.
Let's talk about bribing. We all know that a blogger shouldn't write about, let's say, a stock that they've invested in. We know that's a clear conflict of interest. But since they're paid by the page view, I see every story they write as a potential conflict of interest. The way they write about it inherently biases them away from the truth and towards what will spread the fastest, what will take the least amount of work, and what will ultimately get the most amount of traffic.
So how did you bribe people?
You dangle the angle in front of them, right? I'll write a draft headline in an article, or I'll hint that this has a sexy picture attached to it.
So you bribe them with the promise of page views, but it isn't bribing with dollars.
In a way, it can also be that too. I mean, I buy advertisements for a variety of my clients, and if you're a one-man shop, you're the guy who's cashing the checks and writing the posts, and there's no way that that doesn't influence who and how you write about things.
Now talk about lying. Give me some examples of your more spectacular lies.
Something that broke last week is what I did through a service called Help a Reporter Out. It's basically a sort of a backroom service where someone says like, oh, I need a source for X, and a source says, oh, I'll be that source. And so I kind of felt like this site was leaving the front door wide open for people to come in and basically pretend to be experts about anything. And so what I did was for the last 6 months, I've pretended to be an expert on this service. I basically told anyone anything that they wanted to hear, even though I didn't know what I was talking about. I said, yeah, sure, I'm an expert on boats. I'm an expert on fitness or insomnia or various health issues. I'm an expert on vinyl records, and of course, I'm not an expert of vinyl records. I don't know what LP stands for. I don't own a turntable, but I was able to fake it enough to fool a reporter at the New York Times for a Sunday piece about a rising trend. When the reporter was ultimately questioned, he said he sounded somewhat credible and not all that different than the other people that I talked to. And that's what a New York Times reporter considers to be his burden of proof. To include someone in, you know, the paper of record.
You wrote that bloggers brandish the correction as though it is some magical balm that heals all wounds.
Bloggers justify this publish first, verify later model with the idea that it's so much easier to issue a correction online, right? You don't have to wait for the next day's paper to issue the correction. You can do it right there at the bottom of the story. But first off, psychologically, that just doesn't pass muster. They've done all sorts of interesting studies. And in fact, there's something called the backfire effect, where reading a correction actually makes you believe the mistake even more than the people who haven't seen the correction. And so that affects, like, let's say you're a publicly traded stock and a blog reports a rumor about your company. It doesn't matter that they corrected it 5 hours later because your stock price still took an unnecessary hit because of it. And now investors are worried about your business.
There are these people who have snuck dangerous things onto planes. They say with the intention of showing how our airport security is really bad.
Right.
Do you worry that your book will be used more as a how-to than as a corrective?
It was something that I thought about a lot, but I ultimately felt like there was no other way to actually get people to pay attention. Not say this stuff could happen, but that this stuff does happen, and I know that because I personally did it.
Are you manipulating me?
I'm not. This is the question that I get most often about this book. I make a lot of money doing this in the shadows. There's a reason that there weren't many Google searches for my name as of a week ago. In order for me to function, I required secrecy. Since I no longer want that secrecy, I'm okay exposing this stuff.
Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
The book is called Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.